Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World.
Whatever else you think about Donald Trump, it's fair to say that he drives the global news cycle. In the process, he spends an awful lot of time demonizing other leaders, other countries, but also plenty of Americans and American institutions. Whether there is purpose in all that noise is debatable, but it's not debatable that there are consequences. High on the president's enemies list is China, and there have been almost nonstop efforts by him and his administration to cut or at least dramatically reduce U.S.-China ties and to force other countries to follow suit. It's an easy case to make that A, it can't be done, and B, it shouldn't be done, but that applies to many of Donald Trump's obsessions. So on this episode of New Thinking for a New World, I want to explore what all this looks like, not from an American perspective or even necessarily a Chinese perspective, but from an Asian perspective. To do that, I've invited Chandra Nair, who is the founder and CEO of the Global Institute for Tomorrow, a Pan-Asian think tank based in Hong Kong and Kuala Lumpur. He is also a successful Malaysian businessman, so he not only thinks about what should be, but also about what actually can be. Welcome, Chandra.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. Privileged to be here.
Chandra, I'd like to approach this from two directions. One, why you think Donald Trump and company are so obsessed with China? And two, from your perspective, how do you think Chinese leaders, not China, view the U.S., not as much in a global context as in an Asian one? Which of those two would you like to start with?
I'll start with the first one, if you don't mind, about what you said. Why does Donald Trump view China as the extreme in adversary, and what is the background to all of that? So I think this is a question that's quite often not answered. People often talk about what is happening, and they put it simply in the context of, you know, the typical theses about geopolitical and big power rivalry, and we've heard all of those theses going back to the canon of Greek history and all of that. And I think that's okay, but that doesn't really get to the core, which is, in my view, and I've written about it, a lot more sensitive to address. And I don't think it's just Donald Trump. I've been living in, I lived all over the world, but the last 30 years I've been based out of Asia, out of the city of Hong Kong, and traveled extensively across Asia as well as China. So I've had a front row seat to the what I would call the miracle of China. But I've noticed, and I've noticed particularly the last 10 years, and you know, I have friends who are editors of The Economist, The Financial Times, et cetera, and New York Times, and all of these international Western media outlets. And I noticed about 10 years ago, almost xenophobic approach towards China. China can't do anything right. And I remember writing a piece maybe 10 years ago. Here's a question for Western media. Can China do anything right? And so this thing started a long time ago. So, yes, we focus on Donald Trump, but Biden was just as bad in terms of being anti-China, etc. You could argue Trump started it, but most U.S. governments, apart from when distracted by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, started to be very anti-China, and Europeans too, I dare say. I have many European friends, and I remember being in Brussels 3-4 years ago and saying, what on earth is wrong with you? Why are you so anti-China? And I said the most important thing the Europeans will have to do is decouple their foreign policy from the European, from the Americans, because it'll begin to harm them, as they're finding out today. So let me get to my answer, and then we can explore it. And I think it's because for the first time in about 400-500 years, Western civilization, which is today, you could say, led by the United States in terms of its military and economic power, is being confronted by a non-Caucasian civilization. And it can't take this. And this has actually been admitted and off the record by a couple of leading American politicians. So you ask me, what's the rest of the world look at? And look at this. And in the last couple of years, particularly with the strong anti-Chinese rhetoric, the world, particularly in Asia, looks at it as almost, my God, these guys are racist. They cannot comprehend a non-Western civilization looking them in the eye and saying, we're here. Are we able to compete? And I think Donald Trump, whatever you want to, however you want to describe him, as a populist, et cetera, felt that he could tap into that, both to be in the news cycle every day, but to also, at the same time, be in America, the person who is going to make America great again. And as we know, there's a strong strain of supremacist attitudes within the American psyche, and he's playing into that. So I would argue that the driver for this is not just Donald Trump. It's steeped in the American psyche. We are number one. We're the hegemon. We're supremacists. And we will not tolerate the emergence of any other civilization that is non-Caucasian. And if they're Caucasian, they're smaller anyway. We can put them back in the box. But this is a true threat. And last point I'll make is my Indian friends sometimes accuse me of being pro-China. And I say to them, as soon as you become successful and organized like the Chinese, they'll be on your case too.
You wrote something in Counterpunch, and there was a rhetorical question. If China became a democracy, would the West still, I don't know if the word was hate it, but oppose it?
Yes, oppose it still.
Oppose it. And your answer?
I think it would still oppose it. I mean, I argue, in fact, the oversimplification of China as a dictatorship and all of that, this is just theater. This is ideological deceptions to demonize the other. I have argued that we have to question, what do we mean by democracy? Is the United States a democracy today? There are many who would argue it's not a democracy, it's a plutocracy. And is democracy, as defined in the West, the only way to govern complex, large societies in the 21st century? In my second book, The Sustainable State, where I essentially look at the existential threats and the convergence, I argue that the large nations of the world outside the West will have to relook how they pursue the creation of fairer, more equitable societies. And I argue that if push come to shove, and you ask me to look at China and India, the two largest nations in the world, I would say that China is more democratic than India. And to provoke my Indian friends and have that debate, I argue that if you're poor today, would you rather be Chinese or Indian? And so what is the system of governance that we seek to essentially promote meant to do? What is it meant to serve? And I would say the Chinese system has done more for its citizens, and therefore, in terms of liberating them from the drudgery of daily life, that the Indian system has. And in recent discussions I've had with in India, I think many of the Indian business leaders, et cetera, privately agree with me. The politicians obviously find it very difficult. But that's partly also because the Indian political elite have been colonized for about 200 years. Even after independence, their mind capture is still strong. They still go to the Western schools. They learn the same old things. And I'm not saying the Chinese system is perfect, but the Chinese have independent thought, and they have retained their civilizational understanding much more profoundly. And then you could say that they have a political system that is committed more to the liberation of the individual from the drudgery of life. Where they go next is a discussion we can all have, but I would say the Chinese political system has delivered more freedom and rights than the Indian system has to the poor Indian. But you have to have lived in and gone to both countries, typically to the most rural areas, etc., to understand what that freedom actually looks like. And it's not the crass definitions that you see on, you know, Western media.
Well, but that's a comparison between China and India. And
yes.
My question is about China and the United States. And
yes.
To your point, perhaps more broadly, the West. Would you argue that China is more democratic than the West?
I would not want to seek to make that comparison, but I would definitely say that the Chinese political system serves its population in ways that the current Western democratic systems cannot. And I think there's also a real danger.
I'm sure some of our audience will wonder, how are you measuring that? How are you imagining it?
Right. So what is democracy in the West? And I think one of the terrible presumptions and people have got away in the West is just use the word democracy and frighten everybody else. We are democratic, therefore we are superior to you. And therefore we are better societies. So what is our democracy actually about? So this is something that is rarely questioned, right? You should not question democracy. So I'm coming here and saying, well, what is that democracy actually? Well, it works for you to a certain extent, but we're now seeing it throughout Europe and in the United States, it doesn't work. Some of us would argue that the United States for the last 10 years at least, has been a failed state. Now, Americans don't like to hear it, but it has not been able to address its most internal issues. So that democracy in the United States works for it. And my view is we don't interfere with that. But the Western idea is somehow it must export its views to the rest of the world. So in China, what has worked is the data that you don't have to believe what I'm saying, go and look into the World Bank and all of that. It is uplifted 750 million people out of poverty in the space of about 35 years. For me, that is freedom. And if you've been to China in the 80s and 90s and seen the stark nature of the human condition, then you will understand that really is delivering on the promise of liberation and uplifting people from the drudgery of life so that they can enjoy the choices. But then I also argue that democracy, as stated in the West, is essentially the individual as king and unfettered freedoms. And we've seen where that has taken many Western societies to. In other countries, and I argue particularly China, India, democracy comes in great responsibilities and will have to be basically have strict boundaries put on it. My argument being that collective welfare takes precedence over individual rights. The individual is not key.
Well, and although that's not where I'd like to go with this conversation, clearly there's an enormous historical and cultural background to that statement, both in terms of how the West evolved its concepts and how China, India, other parts of Asia evolved that concept. And indeed, you are certainly right that in the post-World War II period, where the institutions were essentially built by the U.S. and Europe, that embedded in those institutions are an historic and cultural understanding of how all this ought to work, which worked in the 40s, worked in the 50s, perhaps, clearly needs to be rethought in at present. But let's go back to, we're still on the U.S. side of it. So the argument, your argument is that there is, that the U.S., the West war generally is stuck almost Groundhog Day-like in the we are the hegemon, we built this world, it's our world, and it's our rules, and hence anything that is not coherent with that view of the rules is somehow unacceptable.
Yes. I think the Europeans have woken up to it. If Donald Trump has done the Europeans a favor, he has woken them up from their deep sleep. Somehow the Europeans, and this is also historical, the sort of allegiance of, if I can be so crude as to say, the white tribe of the world, that we are all together and the rest, as I think the former foreign minister of the EU said, you know, Europe and the West is a garden, the rest of the world is a jungle, and my God, they're coming here. Well, I think the Europeans have woken up to, my God, we understand, But we thought, and deep inside the European psyche, and I understand it, is, my God, we were number one. We know more. And now these people are coming. But Uncle Sam is telling us we can still be number one. He's got the guns. He's got the military might. He's got the economic power to sanction all of this. Let's just stay with him. And so you have, you know, the irony of me sitting in Southeast Asia, the Australians always side with the West. And we look at them and say, very interesting, these guys. They want to trade with all of us. But when push comes to shove, they're with Uncle Sam. That's a deeper conversation. So I think the Europeans are beginning to understand. But the Americans somehow have not understood this. And it's, I think, partly isolation, but it's also history. The history of settler communities that have rooted in the view of we are number one. And of course, the American sense of exceptionalism, which is reinforced day in and day out by media, even liberal media. I mean, I stopped watching CNN and all of these people because no matter what, it's almost a code that you have to turn up there and say we are number one. And very few nations actually do it so obscenely as the Americans do. And so it's become part of the psychology of an entire nation. You can't oppose Donald Trump, but we're still number one. So it's no coincidence that the anti-China sentiment of the United States is bipartisan. You know, it's one thing they can all come together. We hate those people. We need to curtail that. We need to curb their rise. We need to do something because they're Chinese. And you say, but why? And they can't explain quite why. So I think the reason the Americans are doing this is, and I wrote a book about dismantling global white privilege, and I cut through the geopolitical area. But I lived in Southern Africa during the apartheid era. And the power of essentially economic power comes from the ability to control others. And you use different mechanisms by which you label them so as to justify your ability and your means of being able to control them. And in the American sense, the fear of losing economic power over the rest of the world, and therefore the elites continuing to enjoy the privileges, be it the exorbitant privilege of the dollar, setting the rules, etc. And dare I say, the continuing economic heft of the military-industrial complex is so rooted in the elites, they can't separate themselves from looking at a different world. So my point would be that, you know, you did say, how would I look at the future? And no one wants to predict. But I think the problem has been for the last 25 years, as China has arisen and its leaders, and I would say most of them have been, you know, pretty good. They have flaws with all leaders everywhere. But they've been exemplary in trying to deal with the issues of their country, take advantage of the economic systems. You can accuse them of taking advantage of certain things in certain ways, and there's mechanisms to deal with it. But they haven't sought to disrupt the world with warfare. So the leaders have been pretty good, but there's been no American leader equivalent to rise to the challenge of the new world. What do we have had? We had George Bush. We had then Barack Obama, nice guy, novice, very popular amongst the liberals, etc. And then we had Donald Trump, we had Biden, and we're back to Trump. So we've had about 30 years of very mediocre leadership in the United States who grabbed the headlines, but none who had a vision of where the world was going. And if they were concerned about China, they can be legitimate. But you can't stop and say that's our policy to curb this other nation from rising without defining what is your fear. And if your fear is essentially one of competition, say so. If it's deeply rooted in your sense of superiority, say so. The rest of the world now, and Donald Trump has done, I feel, done everyone a favor. The rest of the world said, we're taking off our mask. We don't like other people. We have to be number one. And we are supremacists. And anybody who comes close to challenging us, we will put them down. Now, you may disagree with me, and some of the viewers may be, but I'm just telling you what most people in this part of the world and Africa think. They said, my God, these guys are taking off their mask and said, they're the same old colonialists, imperialists. And Donald Trump is just saying, I'm shameless. I don't care about that.
China's point of view, but you're not speaking for China.
Yeah, I'm not speaking for China, no.
About
yeah.
China, because you live in the neighborhood, you have studied China like me, you've traveled extensively to China. So the Chinese, as you've said, have done an amazing job of taking a country that was a moment ago a backwater in terms of the capacity of its people to feed themselves, to clothe themselves, to develop, to grow. And they've built world-class universities. They've built world-class industries.
Sure.
And we are where we are. Now, whether or not China's the largest, second largest, they're a very important country. They are clearly, as Xi Jinping said to Barack Obama when they had the summit in Sunnylands, he said, it is reported that you are the legacy power. We're the rising power. That doesn't mean, it shouldn't mean either that we are inevitably going to be in conflict.
Exactly.
Nor should it mean that the fact that I'm recognizing you're the legacy power means that you're a declining power. I'm not saying that. I'm saying
exactly.
You're the legacy power. That's an objective fact. So we are where we are. What does China want in your perspective? What kind of world do they want based on what we could see today?
I appreciate you reminding me that, you know, and your the view is that, you know, I'm not speaking as a Chinese. I'm not Chinese, but I've watched very carefully. If I was speaking to an Indian audience, I would talk about me watching Indian. I'm of Indian origin, but I was born in Malaysia. I'm speaking from the perspective of a non-Chinese person in Asia, but has lived all around the world. So what does China want? I think what China wants is simply this. And my advice to China is something different. I'll mention it later. I think what China is committed to, in my understanding, is firstly, its people. It realizes that it's come from a very low base. It's achieved numerous success, lots of success, but it has a lot more to do. One of the misconceptions is that all Chinese are now living, driving EV cars and are rich and have, you know, air-conditioned homes and all of that. This is complete nonsense. You know, 500 million Chinese are better off than anywhere else in the world, despite being poor. And that is a tribute to the Chinese governance system of common prosperity, et cetera. And which is why I'm quite critical of the Indian system, right? Because I say they got too much democracy. So that's something to think about. So I think what they want is, what else do we need to do? They've also recognized that having gone on the path of opening up their markets and creating a consumer economy, they have reached certain thresholds that will be disastrous if they don't start to curb the way that economy works. And this is essentially what they have termed the eco-civilization dilemma. And President Xi is the only global leader who has spoken very openly and articulately about it, and in fact said to the whole nation, particularly leaders and political and business leaders, there's a red line. And if you cross that red line, the government will have to act. So it wants to preserve the integrity of the nation, but it also understands a nation of over 1.3 billion people now has huge ecological constraints it will have to deal with. It knows that it has created technological advances, but those technological advances at the same time will need to be harnessed for societal goods, so societal good, rather than technology is simply an economic driver that will create whatever outcomes and all of those will be good. The last point of what China wants, in my view, is it wants a peaceful world in which it will have a say, it will not be demonized, misrepresented, but it can contribute. And I think the concept of the Chinese concept of a shared future for humanity is dismissed too easily by a rather jaded liberal Western media that thinks, these guys can't mean any of that, they're Chinese. I think this is badly understood. So it wants a shared humanity, a future, taking into consideration all the challenges. And as you said earlier, with President Xi had said, to live in harmony with a superpower like the United States. And I think very importantly, as you said, it doesn't want to see the United States decline. I think China understands that a strong United States, and I believe this too, the rest of the world, is very important. But a rogue United States led by politicians and two parties that seem to be completely out of control is bad for all of us. And that's why people like me react to why are they trying to disrupt all of us? The Chinese view is we are strong enough. We can counter this. We can take more pain. But really, what we want to do is we do not want to overtake the United States. We're happy for the United States to be top dog, but don't bully us. We will not blink.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Chinese strategy and express strategy for some time has been the bumper sticker, Asia for Asians, the nine-dash line. The United States is not an Asian power, and it ought to be pushed back or pull itself back, depending the dynamic. So I'm a little skeptical that China is a benign power in the way you've described it, but I don't know. It's a question. I do know that China is now building, already has one of the world's largest navy, if not the largest, and it's dramatically expanding it. I do know that it's investing very heavily in offensive weapons, in missiles, in space, in air power. And I do know that the history of China has not been expansionary. We all know the history, but it clearly is building the capacity that could allow it to do so. Now, I think that's less of a concern if you're sitting in the West than it might be if you're sitting in Asia, and you're sitting in Asia. So is there some going on, which would be historical? Because, again, China has never projected power beyond its borders.
A very good point that you mentioned here. The Chinese buildup of military power, et cetera, as you know, is still a fraction of the United States. It's a fraction. And the data is out there. Anyone who wants to go and check. But if you were Chinese...
But it's a fraction because it started more recently. The rate of change
Its rate is growing.
Dramatic. Exactly. So let's keep facts here. It is a fraction because they started later. But they're moving much more aggressively than they ever had.
But the United States is moving very aggressively too. So let's say you're Chinese. You say, these guys are telling us, we'll come to your area, we will show our military presence, etc. And all options are on the table. If I was China, I'm not saying the Chinese are just going to be passive. They've got pride too. So, well, we have to stand up to these guys. But what I am very clear is there will be no war in Asia initiated by the Chinese. If there is to be warfare, it'll be initiated by the United States. And I can tell you that most Asians believe that too. Now, when you come to the nine-dot line and all of those things, of course, I come from Southeast Asia. Of course, we're concerned about this. But you know what? We don't think these guys are going to take over our islands and do this. Yeah, they're taking over a bit of this and that, but we'll talk to them. So the other thing that I've written about this is Western diplomats have forgotten that they are meant to be diplomats. They're not meant to be, they're not to be salesmen for the defense industry. And they've forgotten all of this. We have very good diplomats in the region. And I have written about this, that one of the things that we need to recapture is we do not need to outsource diplomacy to Europeans and Americans who know nothing about the region, speak one language typically, and come here and tell us how to suck eggs, if I can be so crude. We need to capture that. We have very good diplomats. But my God, as soon as there's any tension, we need some American, some Norwegian, some Scandinavian to come here and tell us this dotted line, by the way, by this part of this island, which we can't pronounce, you guys need to do this. That's our problem. So to this issue about Asia for Asians, that's not a Chinese thing. That's an Asian thing. Why should we have Americans and trust them to dictate to us? So this is, again, the assumption that the Americans are benign, that they are okay. You can just trust us. Well, the history is very bad. I'm from Southeast Asia. I remember Vietnam. I remember what happened in Indonesia. I remember all of these things. So we are not just Chinese. Say, we don't trust these guys anymore. So I think that is absolutely right. We do not need American security at the expense of us taking charge. And why should I trust the American more than the Chinese? Who said the American is more trustworthy? If you look at the track record, no, they're not. But do we want the Americans to be a partner with us? Of course.
Let me just add, just to be clear, I think you are certainly right that the West in general, the U.S. in particular, parachuting in with solutions, I think is mostly a thing of the past. It wasn't a particularly good thing in the past. I think it's a bit of a red herring going into the future.
So I'll take Southeast Asia and I'll make a little comment about, you know, North Asia and all of that. And for those who are interested, I've written about this, particularly about diplomacy. And we need to get rid of the Europeans and Americans from telling us how to run our region. If we can't even think for ourselves, then we deserve the worst. But coming back to your point, in Southeast Asia, what the rest of Asia wants, and you have to remember, there's a large Chinese population dominant economically in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Philippines, Vietnam, etc. So the cultural links are very deep. So what the countries want, and I can speak about just the recent ASEAN summit, as you probably know, and that was an ASEAN GCC China summit on Tuesday or Thursday in KL. All the GCC leaders turned up with China and ASEAN. So what ASEAN wants is, and ASEAN is about 700 million people, might peak at about 900, huge bloc, very poor, lots of natural resources, and I would dare I say peaceful for the last 50 years, but its biggest challenges are ahead of itself. What we want is China to be a friend as it has been for a long time. Friend, invest, bring its know-how, technology, allow us to trade with it. I mean, China's ASEAN is, I think, China's second largest trading partner now. So we want trade. And as far as all the maritime issues, et cetera, it's a cliche, but there is the ASEAN way. And many people in the West don't understand it. It's called the Asian way. You know, we sit down, we talk, we don't call you names. We don't go on CNN and say, yeah, that guy is a dictator. That's the Western way. It plays to an audience. You know, we guys know what's right and wrong. There's a different way. It's behind the scenes. We talk and we settle things. And that's what's going to happen. So we want the tensions not to be, increased by rhetoric from the United States and Europe. We want to work with the Chinese. And we will tell, I mean, the little work I'm doing with the Chinese foreign ministry is exactly that. They want to know, hey, what do people actually think? And I tell them unvarnished what I believe they need to be doing. For instance, I tell them that they need to be very careful about their desire to do trade, desire to have access to resources, but not to become a colonial empire. And not taking things for free, but taking things cheaply and doing things unfairly. I've also talked to them about Chinese businesses. I mean, it's like this. If Rio Tinto goes to Irian Jaya and exploits the land and creates an environmental catastrophe, people say it's Rio Tinto. They don't say it's the Australian government. If a Chinese company is somewhere in Thailand or Cambodia and messes up, they say, it's those guys in commies in Beijing. And it's President Xi who sent these guys to destroy Cambodia. So I've told the Chinese, and they're the only country that can do this, curb their companies acting in ways that are not good in the national interest as well as those countries. So what we want is China to trade fair and China not to impose its will on others because we are smaller. And for us to be able to negotiate with the Chinese, the ASEAN summit and all the negotiations with the Chinese, which the Western media never reports on, is doing it the ASEAN way, the Asian way. We talk, we don't call you names, we sit down and we do quiet diplomacy. And we don't need Norwegians or Scandinavians and Europeans at that table, because we should be able to do it. And so I think that's what we want. Peace, stability, negotiations. We understand they are the big brother, and we're going to try to tell them, please respect us too. And that is happening on many levels too. So I think that's what we want.
And last question, do you expect that that is the course events will take, that they indeed will recognize, and again, we're within the Asian context, that as relationships evolve and change over the next years, which they're changing very, very fast, that they'll evolve in that collaborative, cooperative way, even recognizing that one's very large and others are not?
Absolutely. I mean, otherwise I'd give up doing the work I do. And even, you know, and I hope I'm not sounding anti-Western. A non-Western view to all your viewers is not anti-Western. I'm a big fan of the West. I think it shot itself in the foot. And I think, as particularly Europeans, they need to see the world beyond the United States. They need to stop talking about the special relationship. I think the ASEAN region has enough power to be able to use its soft power to talk to the Chinese. But more importantly, the Chinese have no interest in total domination. And where the Chinese do behave in ways that we feel is no good, quite often it's a reaction to the threat being imposed on it from the West. So I think this is absolutely the way. And this is why I keep saying to the West, and you know, here I'll repeat it, to the United States, play a constructive role. Stop being exceptionalists. Listen to us. We have better diplomats than you have. And listen to our diplomats. And don't always want to be at the front of the table and dominate. And this is an arrogance that, you know, diplomats in the West don't understand. Partly it's our subservience. You know, if you've been colonized for a long time, the moment someone from the West walks into the room, we just all, you know, part ways and let the white guy walk in to put some humor to this. And that's how it is. But that future that you just painted is absolutely what I think will happen. But external pressures, geopolitics led by the United States is the unknown factor. There will be no war in Asia, in my view. No war unless the United States instigates it. And, you know, the recent thing with Pakistan and India, the United States took credit for apparently brokering the peace, but there was a lot of other diplomats at work from the region too. And if the United States can broker that sort of peace, well done. That's what we need. But there will be no war in this region unless a hot war is sparked by the belligerence of the United States. I think the Chinese will not do this. And the idea that China will invade Australia, I mean, it's laughable. It's laughable. But this is the military-industrial complex at play. And we in this part of the world, particularly in Southeast Asia, say, what are the Australians doing? They are arming themselves to the tilt and then talking about Chinese invasions, etc. I mean, who cares about
Australia? I will go back and point out that the Chinese are arming themselves beyond the tilt. They have the most aggressive armaments program in the world, perhaps for good reason. I'm not arguing the contrary. But
you would do the same if your neighbor
different
said,
point. Different point. If they're doing
Come on, be realistic. That is a superpower, that there's a history of invasion, dropping bombs on other people, sanctioning everybody, and saying, we are going to essentially prevent you from rising. We have to control you. What would you do if you already, you've got a civilization, you're 5,000 years, you're being bullied, you're being intimidated, and you're being told, we might come in, you know, attack you guys. And by the way, you cannot do anything. Please, I would do the same. And then, as you said, I'm coming from a low base. It does look like I'm going all this way up. But this is the escalation. And I think we need to really stop this. But I don't think the Chinese are going to invade anybody. No, they've got enough problems of their own. If you've traveled in China, you will know that there's so much to be done there. And they've done a brilliant job of that. So, you know, I hope I've not painted a picture that China has some problems, that China is just simply benign. But I think the exaggeration that China... And my question to people is, why are you afraid of China? And often when I speak to my liberal friends, they say, oh man, you know, it's human rights and all of this. I said, you know, after Gaza, no Westerners should talk to me about human rights, please. We know their hypocrisy. So the view that the Westerners, the Europeans, care about human rights of other people, I've always laughed at because I know the history of the West. So whilst the Western powers, the French, were talking about liberation and all of that, I mean, they're the worst colonizers in the world. I mean, you know, so suddenly you care about human rights. We're not stupid. Human rights are just as important to us as in the West. And the idea that some of Westerners have a better understanding while essentially restricting us from our human rights for decades, even whilst you were democracies, is laughable. And many of our leaders are subservient, by the way. And that, too, is not properly understood. The Japanese are totally subservient. The Koreans are subservient. That is beginning to change. And what is being appreciated in this part of the world, and then I say Africa, but we're not talking about Africa, is that the Chinese have stood up. And not everyone is a friend of China, I agree, but the respect China is gaining is not fully appreciated in the Western world. And the more the United States demonizes China, the more people are seeing through this and saying, why are they afraid of these people? Why are they? So that you understood.
I think that is a very good place to end, because I agree wholeheartedly with you that the West in general spends too much time talking to itself and not listening to what's going on in the rest of the world. And as you've described it, the conversation globally is changing dramatically. So thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.